Welcome to this deep dive, and we are diving into the fascinating world of butterflies.
Butterflies.
Specifically, how they're adapting to a changing climate.
Oh, wow.
You sent us some research about three threatened species in Sweden.
Yeah.
The marsh fritillary, the Apollo, and the large blue.
Okay.
And what really caught our eye was how they use temperature to their advantage.
It is a delicate balance, isn't it? Butterflies need warmth, but too much heat can be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
What's intriguing about this research is that it looks at how these butterflies,
yeah,
even sharing the same habitat, have evolved different strategies for thriving in a world of fluctuating temperatures.
Right. So let's introduce our butterfly stars.
Okay.
First up, we have the marsh fritillary, active from May to June.
Think vibrant orange-brown wings with black markings.
Wow.
They're drawn to damp meadows where they lay their eggs on the underside of devil's bit scabious leaves.
Interesting.
Their larvae are real team players, living in silken webs and feeding together on the plant.
Wow. And then we have the Apollo. Quite a contrast in terms of appearance.
Yes. The Apollo is a showstopper with large white wings and those striking black and red markings.
Really pretty.
They prefer rocky, sun-drenched habitats.
Okay.
And are active a bit later, from June to August.
Okay.
Unlike the marsh fritillary, their larvae are picky eaters, dining exclusively on stonecrop sedum.
Oh, picky, picky.
With eaters.
So we have a social butterfly and a bit of a loner.
Right.
What about our third species, the large blue?
The large blue, despite its name, is actually quite small, with shimmering blue wings speckled with dark spots.
Mm-hmm.
They're active during the hottest months, July and August.
Okay.
And favor dry grasslands, but here's the twist.
Okay.
Their larvae have a rather, shall we say, complicated relationship with ants.
Oh.
Specifically Myrmica ants.
Interesting.
They actually trick the ants into raising them in their nests.
Wow.
Going so far as to feed on the ant brood.
So we've got teamwork, solitary living, and a bit of ant world espionage. Intriguing strategies, not just for survival, but for raising the next generation as well.
Exactly. And that's a crucial point, because all three of these butterflies are what we call univoltine.
Meaning they only have one generation per year.
That's right.
So the timing of everything, their flight period, egg laying, larval development, is incredibly important.
Precisely. And this is where the researchers' findings on their different flight periods and temperature preferences become so fascinating.
Right. Because the study looked at when each butterfly was active and, more importantly, at what temperatures.
Yes.
And they were looking at what's called the utilized temperature,
mm-hmm,
which is different from just air temperature, right?
Exactly. Utilized temperature refers to the range of temperatures at which the butterflies were actually observed to be active.
Right.
Flying, feeding, mating.
Got it.
It gives us a much more nuanced view of their thermal preferences than simply looking at the overall temperature of their environment.
Okay, so let's talk flight schedules.
Okay.
What did the researchers find?
Well, as you might expect, given their different activity periods, the three butterflies had distinct flight times.
Mm-hmm.
The marsh fritillary, our early bird, flies from May to June, followed by the Apollo from June to August.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, the large blue takes to the skies from July to August.
So a staggered schedule, almost like shift work in the butterfly world.
Yeah, I like that.
Do you think this could be a way to reduce competition for nectar?
That's a very good question.
Yeah.
And it relates to something called the competitive displacement hypothesis.
Okay.
Which suggests that species with less overlap in resource use tend to coexist more successfully.
Right.
This research didn't specifically test that hypothesis, but it certainly raises the question of whether the staggered flight schedule helps these butterflies share the limited nectar resources in their habitat.
So maybe avoiding the butterfly equivalent of rush hour at the nectar bar.
Exactly.
Makes sense. But let's get to the real heart of the matter. How are these butterflies dealing with temperature, especially those high temperatures?
This is where it gets really interesting. The researchers found that all three species actually preferred the highest temperatures available,
mm-hmm,
most of the time. But, and this is important, their responses to those high temperatures varied quite a bit.
This goes against the idea that all butterflies are simply heat-seeking, right?
Right.
There must be nuances based on when they fly and what temperatures they can actually handle.
Right. For example, the marsh fritillary, active in the cooler months of May and June, showed an interesting pattern.
Okay.
While they preferred warmer temperatures overall, they actually became less active during the hottest part of the day in midsummer.
It sounds like they know when to take a break from the heat.
That's right.
What about the Apollo flying during those peak summer months?
The Apollo being active during the hottest time of year was also a bit more heat tolerant. But even they reduce their activity at midday during the most extreme temperatures.
So even the sun lovers have their limits. And what about the large blue, flying in the heat of July and August? Mm. How do they handle those high temperatures?
The large blue was also a fan of high temperatures, but they adjusted their schedule, shifting their peak activity to earlier in the day when temperatures were warmest.
Like getting their errands done before the midday sun becomes too intense.
Yeah.
Fascinating. So, while they all seem to prefer warmer temperatures, they've also evolved ways to cope with those extremes.
Exactly. And this is where the researchers started to dig into the role of body size and coloration in all of this.
Okay, so let's talk butterfly fashion. How do their size and color play into this whole temperature dance?
Well, body size and coloration are known to be key factors in how insects regulate their temperature.
Right.
There's research suggesting that in warmer climates, you tend to see smaller, paler butterflies because they can stay cooler more easily.
Makes sense. But did that hold true for these three species?
That's where things get even more intriguing.
Okay.
This study actually found something a bit different. Remember the Apollo, our largest butterfly?
Mm-hmm.
It's also the one active during the hottest periods, but its light coloration might actually be helping it avoid overheating, especially considering its reduced midday activity.
So it's like having a built-in shade umbrella.
Yeah.
What about our smaller, darker butterflies, the marsh fritillary and the large blue?
Their darker colors might actually be beneficial for absorbing heat during those cooler periods early and late in the season.
Right.
And remember those black larvae we mentioned?
Yeah.
That dark coloration might help the marsh fritillary and Apollo larvae warm up quickly in early spring when they're just getting started.
It's like they've got their own little thermal suits. Amazing.
And there's more.
Oh.
The researchers also looked at the connection between lifespan and this ability to utilize different temperatures.
Okay.
What they found was that the relationship between how long a butterfly lived and its utilized temperature actually varied across the three species.
Wait, so you're saying that different butterflies have different relationships between temperature and how long they live?
Yes, that's exactly what we're saying.
That's fascinating. Tell me more about what they found.
Well, with the marsh fritillary, the individuals that lived longer were the ones that had both a higher average utilized temperature and a wider range of utilized temperatures.
So for them being able to handle a variety of temperatures was key to a longer life.
Mm-hmm.
What about the Apollo? How did temperature affect their lifespan?
The Apollo was different. Their lifespan actually decreased with a higher average utilized temperature. But here's the interesting part. Their lifespan still increased if they were able to utilize a wider range of temperatures.
So even for a butterfly that prefers warmth, being a bit of a temperature generalist, being able to handle a wider range seems to be beneficial. What about the large blue? How did temperature relate to their lifespan?
Their response was the most complex. They showed what's called a curvilinear relationship,
right,
meaning their lifespan peaked at a certain temperature and then started to decline again if it got either hotter or colder.
Mm-hmm.
But just like the other two species, their lifespan increased if they utilized a wider range of temperatures.
This raises a really interesting question. If being able to handle a wider range of temperatures is advantageous for all these butterflies, why haven't all butterflies evolved this ability?
That's a great question. And it suggests that there are probably trade-offs involved. Perhaps specializing in a narrower temperature range allows for greater efficiency in other areas.
Right.
Foraging or reproduction, at least in stable environments. But in a world where temperatures are becoming more unpredictable, that flexibility might be giving these butterflies an edge.
Mm-hmm.
This study really highlights how natural selection is shaping these butterflies to cope with a changing climate.
So it's not just about finding the perfect temperature. It's about being able to roll with the punches, so to speak, as temperatures fluctuate. And this is giving me a whole new appreciation for these little creatures.
They really are quite remarkable. But now let's get to the big question looming over all of this. What do these findings mean in the face of climate change?
That's the question hanging over so many species these days.
Yeah.
We've seen these amazing adaptations. But are they enough to cope with the rapid pace of climate change? What did the researchers have to say about that?
Well, they emphasized that understanding these butterflies' thermal limits and their unique adaptations is absolutely crucial for developing effective conservation strategies.
Okay.
For instance, knowing that the Apollo's lifespan actually decreases at higher temperatures could inform how we manage their habitats.
So maybe focusing on creating or preserving those cooler microclimates within their rocky habitats.
Precisely. It could involve things like maintaining shady areas, ensuring access to water sources, or even planting vegetation that provides a buffer against extreme heat, and for the large blue with their intricate relationship with those Myrmica ants.
Right.
Conservation efforts might need to consider the ants' needs as well.
Because if the ants are negatively impacted by climate change, the large blue will suffer too. It's like a domino effect.
Yes.
Exactly. Conservation becomes even more complex when you have these interconnected species. The researchers also stress the importance of ongoing monitoring of these butterfly populations. Mm. Tracking their numbers over time can help us understand how they're responding to ongoing climate change and whether our conservation efforts are actually making a difference.
It's like we're learning alongside them, constantly adapting our approach as we gather more data. This research also highlights a point you made earlier about the subtle but significant impacts of climate change.
Right.
We often focus on those dramatic events like wildfires or floods.
Yeah.
But even small shifts in temperature can have these ripple effects on species survival and those intricate relationships within ecosystems.
It's a great point. This study shows that climate change isn't some distant threat. It's happening right now in ways that we might not always see. And these subtle changes, like a shift in temperature, can have huge consequences for these delicate balances in nature.
It really underscores the need to understand how different species are responding. We can't just lump all butterflies together. Each one has its own story, its own set of vulnerabilities and adaptations.
And that diversity of responses is something we need to pay attention to. It's like each species is giving us a piece of the puzzle to understand how life on Earth will be affected by a changing climate.
And this brings us to the broader question of ecosystem health.
Yeah.
These butterflies, as small as they seem, play a role in the bigger picture.
Yeah, absolutely. They're not just pretty faces flitting about. They're pollinators. They're a food source for other animals. And those intricate relationships they have, like the large blue with those ants, all contribute to maintaining biodiversity.
So if their populations decline, it could unravel the whole ecosystem.
Exactly. And those effects might not be immediately obvious. It could lead to a decline in other pollinators, a decrease in certain plant species, and even changes in predator-prey relationships. It's all interconnected.
It's like a delicate web, and climate change is tugging at those threads, threatening to unravel the whole thing. It feels a bit overwhelming, but I also remember you saying that there's a message of hope here. Even in the face of this challenge, what makes you optimistic?
Well, I find hope in the resilience of life itself, even amidst these dramatic changes. We see species like these butterflies adapting, finding new ways to survive. And we as humans have this incredible capacity for innovation and problem solving.
We need to channel that butterfly adaptability on a human scale.
I love that analogy. We need to be creative, collaborative, and persistent in our efforts to address climate change and protect biodiversity.
So what can we do? It's easy to feel helpless in the face of such a big issue. What actions can we take to actually make a difference?
I think it starts with recognizing the urgency of the situation and being willing to make changes in our own lives.
Okay.
Simple things like driving less consuming, less being mindful of our energy, use of these everyday choices can add up.
And using our voices to advocate for change, supporting policies that promote renewable energy conservation and sustainable development.
Exactly. Holding our leaders accountable and demanding action on climate change is crucial. But there are also things we can do right here in our communities.
Like what?
Supporting local conservation organizations, planting native plants to provide food and habitat for pollinators, and even just talking to friends and family about the importance of biodiversity.
It's about connecting those global issues to our local actions,
mm.
Understanding that even small changes can have a ripple effect. What other lessons can we learn from these butterflies, from their struggles and their resilience?
I think one of the most important takeaways is that adaptation is an ongoing process. It's not a one-time event. Species are constantly evolving and responding to their environment.
So it's not a question of if they can adapt, but whether they can adapt fast enough to keep up with the pace of change.
That's the challenge with climate change. It's happening at a rate that's unprecedented in human history. Many species are struggling to keep up. And that brings us to a crucial question. How can we as humans support the adaptive capacity of these species? How can we help them navigate this rapidly changing world?
That's a huge question. We've talked about protecting habitats, mitigating climate change,
mm-hmm.
but are there other more proactive ways to boost their resilience?
That's where things get really fascinating. Some researchers are exploring the idea of assisted evolution.
Assisted evolution.
Which involves helping species adapt more quickly.
What does that mean? Are we talking about genetically modifying butterflies?
Not necessarily. It could involve things like identifying individuals that are naturally more tolerant of heat or drought, and then breeding them together to enhance those traits in future generations.
So giving them a little boost in the right direction.
Exactly. It's a complex approach with ethical considerations, but it's one that's being seriously explored in light of the climate crisis we're facing. It makes you realize that conservation is no longer just about preserving what is. It's about preparing for what's to come. It's about being proactive and innovative in our approach.
And I think despite the challenges, there's a message of hope in this research. Seeing how these butterflies are adjusting their behaviors, their timing, even their physiology, reminds us that life finds a way.
Absolutely. And that ingenuity, that resilience, should inspire us to keep searching for solutions, to keep pushing the boundaries of conservation, to keep fighting for a future where these amazing creatures can continue to thrive.
These butterflies have given us a lot to think about. But I'm curious, if these changes are happening in Sweden, what does it mean for biodiversity on a global scale? Are we seeing similar patterns elsewhere? It's a question that has me thinking about those delicate balances on a much larger scale. Are these Swedish butterflies just one example of a global phenomena?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
This research gives us a fascinating glimpse into how some species are coping, but it's just a snapshot of a much larger and more complex picture.
Right.
It's highly probable that what we're seeing with the marsh fritillary, the Apollo, and the large blue in Sweden is happening with countless other insect species all over the world.
Wow.
Each species facing its own unique challenges based on its environment and life cycle.
So it's like a global experiment is playing out with different species responding in different ways.
Right.
We're trying to piece together the results as we go, but it seems like the overall trend isn't very encouraging.
You're right. When we zoom out and look at the bigger picture, the research is starting to paint a rather concerning picture for biodiversity globally.
Oh.
We're seeing changes in species distributions as they try to track suitable climates. We're seeing shifts in the timing of biological events like migration and breeding. And sadly, we're also seeing extinctions happening at a rate that's alarmingly high.
It's not just about losing individual species, is it? It's about disrupting entire ecosystems, those complex webs of life we've been talking about.
Precisely, climate change is acting as a threat multiplier, putting extra pressure on ecosystems that are already stressed by things like habitat loss, pollution, and invasive species. It's creating new challenges that we're only just beginning to understand.
It can feel a bit overwhelming to think about all of this.
Yeah.
But I keep coming back to that message of hope you mentioned earlier. What gives you that optimism in the face of such a daunting challenge?
I find hope in the sheer resilience of life. Even in the face of these unprecedented changes, we see species like these butterflies adapting, finding new ways to survive, to persist. And as humans, we have an incredible capacity for innovation, for problem solving. We faced enormous challenges before, and we found ways to overcome them.
It's like we need to tap into that same butterfly adaptability, but on a human scale.
Exactly. We need to be creative, collaborative, and persistent in our efforts to mitigate climate change and its impacts on biodiversity. We have to act with urgency, but also with a sense of hope and possibility.
So where do we go from here? What can we do as individuals to feel less overwhelmed and more empowered to make a difference?
It starts with acknowledging the problem, recognizing that this is a real and pressing issue, and then it's about being willing to make changes in our own lives to reduce our environmental impact. Things like driving less consuming, less being mindful of our energy use. These everyday choices might seem small, but they can collectively make a big difference.
And we can use our voices, right?
Yeah.
Advocate for policies that support renewable energy, protect natural habitats, and promote sustainable development.
Absolutely. We need to hold our leaders accountable and demand action on climate change. It's not just about individual actions, it's about systemic change as well. And there's so much we can do in our own communities.
Yeah.
Supporting local conservation groups, planting native species to support pollinators, even just educating our friends and family about the importance of biodiversity. These actions all contribute to a more sustainable future.
It's about making those connections between the global and the local understanding that even small local actions can contribute to addressing a global challenge. It's amazing how these butterflies have led us to this much broader discussion. Is there one final takeaway you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think it comes back to curiosity. This whole conversation started with your curiosity about those Swedish butterflies. And that curiosity led us to explore questions about climate change conservation and the interconnectedness of life on Earth. Never underestimate the power of asking questions, seeking knowledge, and being open to different perspectives. That's what drives us forward. That's what inspires us to find solutions.
It's a reminder to stay curious, stay engaged, and never stop diving deep.
Thanks for joining us on this incredible journey.